Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Future Proofing Now, Season 2, Episode 5. Sean Moffitt and Andrea Cates will be talking today about future readiness, and we'll talk about research and findings and some very interesting trends that we see that are applicable to growing corporate divisions and growing companies. So let's get started. I'm Andrea Cates, and I'd like to welcome my partner in crime here, Sean Moffitt, to talk about future readiness and what it really means for a company to be able to grow. And I'd also like to talk to, I'd like to welcome Joanne, who is our partner in crime in terms of the community. And thank you, Joanne, for everything that we do together to make these webcasts possible. So the biggest question is, can we create a different future? And we, of course, are in 2020, and everyone has sort of discussed to death the fact that it's 2020 vision. But we also have a perspective on future-proofing that I think Sean and I will present today, and we are open to the feedback from the group as well. If you would like to have a question, you can do it in the chat, you can do it in the Q&A, and we'll be monitoring that. And we'll also start as a little bit of conversation back and forth about some of the timely headlines around this topic, and we'll talk about tools as well. I think the first important question is, clearly we have a point of view. Can we predict the future? So I'll weigh in on this first, and then I'm going to turn to Sean, because this is the week of the apocalyptic pandemic. It's been a really serious couple of weeks in terms of the coronavirus and what people around the world are doing about it. And the big question though for us is, when it comes to corporate growth, is can we predict the future? And I'll start with a statement, a very strong statement, that we are not arrogant enough to think that we could or should predict the future. Our strong point of view is this notion of agency. And one of our colleagues, Ennis Olson, has a great quote about the importance of corporate leaders having a perspective on what we want the future to be and driving our organizations toward that future, certainly not being victims of the future. So in the week of the coronavirus and lots of scary things going on around the world having to do with prediction, Sean, how do you feel about this question? Can we predict the future, especially as corporate leaders?
Yeah, maybe we're getting better at it. And the reason why I chose this article was, if you look at the date of the article, September 20th, 2019, this was actually 3 months before the first patient started showing up in Wuhan province in China with symptoms of a flu. So, you know, people were thinking about this, like a pandemic was going to happen. So, you know, we can get general real estate. The challenge is, what do I do with that? Because I'm sure if these people knew in September exactly what was going to go down, we wouldn't be experiencing what we do now. So prediction business, no. And I think we have another piece here of, this was a book that was written in 1968 by some of the complete experts of the day, either consultants or people who worked in technology, people that worked in Silicon Valley too, Andrea, and they kind of said, okay, what's 2018 gonna look like? And some people got some pretty close things. They talked about global warming, they talked about the potential for some type of dictatorship to end up running the world potentially, but they also came up with a whole bunch of what might be considered absurd things, like weaponized hurricanes, and they actually predicted global production to be 5 times as big as it is from 1968. It's actually now 20 times. So they're off by a fair factor. So just more proof and testament that even the smartest people of 1968 couldn't get the next 50 years right. And I'm sure the smartest people of 2020 won't get 2070 right. Any thoughts on this one, Andrew?
Yeah, so I'd like to interject. You know, we've been in the strategy business for, although we say 15, it's probably been more like 20 years. And I remember years ago at Royal Dutch Shell, you know, this notion of scenario planning, and there was no end to how many scenarios there might be. And so the question is, can we predict? Probably not. Can we prepare? Definitely. And the other question is, if we have enough factor analysis and pattern recognition, we can be prepared for a lot of kind of fuzzy situations without feeling that we actually have to predict exactly what it would be. And I know you and I have a philosophy around relative and dynamic data instead of you know, absolute data. So we might not know exactly what's going to happen, but mindsets around pandemics and mindsets around preparation for big change. We kind of hate the word disruption, but unfortunately, you know, that's the other thing that corporate leaders deal with is how to get ready for the unknown. And I think that one of the things that's really interesting and a little bit frightening to me is I remember years ago, I went to a briefing at CSIS, the Center for Strategic Initiatives in Washington. And it was, maybe 100 people or so being briefed on bird flu, right, which was very concerning to people. And once again, it was really interesting from an epidemiological perspective and from a policy perspective and from a corporate perspective to think about, you know, what are the implications? And so all of the thinking around it, I think really did prepare people for what ended up not, thank goodness, becoming a huge global pandemic. But the notion of corporate leaders really being aware of changing forces and having a mindset around this notion of preparation, that's very in line with what we say here at Future Proofing. So I'm going to ask you a question. So why should we care? Why should we care about the future? If we know we can't predict it, you know, and we know that there's lots of, you know, sort of press and ink around everything's changing and, you know, we are out of control. What can corporate leaders, you know, why should we really think deeply about this future?
Yeah, I'm going to invoke one of your own terms that you often say. It's like, catch up, don't give up, which I think is the point of view of a lot of people out there where they're like, you know, do I just throw in the towel right now and say, you know what, Netflix is way ahead of me in this world or Google is way ahead of me in this world. The reality is you're abdicating your responsibility as a leader, as somebody that probably services their customers, employees, their shareholders. You know, the world is operating at breakneck speed. It'll be even faster later on, both the pace of the marketplace of accepting stuff and the pace of technology advancing stuff is so much faster. I know this is going to be kind of a visual in our book, I believe. The marketplace is about 4 times faster than it was. The interesting thing, too, is customers are taking a complete toll on businesses. There's a recent study that said customers expect 28% more out of their businesses year over year, but the companies are only delivering or only capable to deliver 6%. So you really aren't looking at linear thinking in terms of trying to create that level of or satisfy that level of customer expectation. Some of the other ones too, just society needs are factoring more. Even one of the supposed enemies of big time change, Goldman Sachs, has, I think we profiled in a previous webinar, spending about $750 billion in what I would call good societal investment. We've slipped over the tipping point now where more than half of executives think that their biggest threat is going to happen outside their industry over the next 5 years, not inside their industry, which would be very different from a decade, 2 decades ago. And finally, I think there is a cultural expectation that whether it's customers or employees, they expect companies to keep pace and stay up with whatever their needs are and whatever the zeitgeist of the time is. So
let me also insert two other ideas that are really core to future proofing. I mean, there used to be this notion of predictive analytics, and we believe in suggestive analytics, that we have deep knowledge of pattern recognition. As you mentioned, Sean, that we look cross industry. And so I think for business leaders, the ability to look from their own industry, but also outside. And also the third thing is, you know, suggestive analytics means that we can kind of zoom out and say, you know, we don't know where this is heading exactly, but we know vaguely where directionally things might be. And I think the final part that we'd like to add is this notion of, can we get customers to weigh in on the future? And I really love the work that is in a book called Leading Transformation, where there's a notion of the ability to incorporate a future perspective, you know, whether it's not exactly science fiction in the fictional sense, but the notion of, you know, where things might be heading so that customers can have what we call focus, a future-oriented customer perspective, where, you know, if you ask somebody, do you want a drone to pick up your child at preschool? The answer is going to be no. You know, all they can think about is the Jetsons, right? So that view of science fiction is not so great, but the ability to think realistically about a future scenario and put customers into a future mindset, immerse them, you know, using whether it's VR, AR, or a lot of techniques that are out today that we actually use, you know, to think, to get people to immerse themselves in a different mindset. I think that's hard for employees. I think it's hard for leaders. I think it's hard for customers. It's hard for everyone, but we must do that dependably to be able to really think about what this future market might look like.
I agree. And I know this is your blind spot here, Andrew. I'm going to invoke some basketball background here. There was this general manager for the Philadelphia 76ers who were perennial also-rans for at least two or three decades. I actually used to be a fan of the team back in the 80s when they were good. And for nearly three decades, they were bad. And at some point in the early 2010s, they were just horrible. And they got a new general manager who essentially intentionally lost all the time. And his point of view to the journalists and the Philadelphia fans who, if you've spent any time in Philadelphia, I mean, you know, I hate to say this, but I mean, Philadelphia fans can eat their own children. They're just...
Yeah, they booed Santa, I remember.
They booed Santa. And actually, somebody said it very clearly. I think it's right. Philadelphia sports fans cheer against the other team, don't cheer for their own team, which I think...
You know, I was born in Philadelphia.
I'm saying some of that because I was like, maybe they come in on that one. But anyway, every time there was a conflict and it's like, is this team on the right direction, intentionally losing and trying to get high draft picks? This general manager would always invoke the term, trust the process. You know what? We don't know where this is all going to go, but if we do this right, we know things are going to get better. Now, I know my Toronto Raptors last year beat the 76ers on a miracle Kawhi Leonard shot, but they are always in the playoffs now. They have two of the better people, better players in the NBA, principally based on his strategy of actually, you know, being last in the league and drafting better. And so I don't want to promote incompetence and intentional losing amongst businesses, but to your point that you were making earlier, Andrew, I think there are signals, there are patterns, there are things and factors that we should be looking at, saying, look, we don't know exactly where these are headed, but with relative certainty, these are the types of things you should be worried about now.
And I'll say one last thing on that, certainly not from the sports perspective. However, the takeaway, I believe, is that it used to be that what we did to prepare for the future was to try to have certainty. We tried really hard to predict and to make sure that our analytics were correct and to make sure our charts were correct. And now that's, even with all the data that's in the system and all the data that's available to us, what we want to say from the future proofing perspective to leaders, and this is what our research and our work in the last 5 years has looked at, is don't worry about the prediction, but that doesn't mean don't prepare. So what we'll talk about today is, how do you prepare for the uncertain future? How do you prepare to be a great leader in these uncertain times? And we now have, you know, we keep saying the jury's back. We know what not to do. So let's start with what not to do. Sean, why don't we start with this this notion of companies that are maybe having some issues in terms of the futures and having some catch up to do.
Yeah, I profiled this slide not to necessarily pick on some companies that I always love lists that also publish the worst of their list, like in full disclosure, which is always great from a transparency. But I did look at who are the worst companies, and generally these were US surveys of the worst customer experiences, company reputations, company cultures, and corporate citizenship. These were them. And as you look at some of these brands, and some of them have had some high profile incidents in the media, I guess this is more of an olive branch to many of my change agents and innovators that are out there going, look, you may be perfect and great at your job, and you may be twice as good as the next person in terms of creating change and innovation. But if some presence of, you know, some competencies and some structures and some leadership aren't in place, it is pushing water uphill. And trust me, I've been in one or two of these situations before. So part of it's an olive branch to change agents. Part of it is, you know, I think in my estimation, I'm curious to know your thought on this too, Andrea. There are only two ways that you can probably effectively innovate and change within the environments I've just exposed here. One is whether it's a change of leadership or leadership finds new religion and says, we need to make a tangible, spirited, new investment and going about this and changing radically how they operate. Or two, they invest in something completely outside of their four walls and create an edge organization that may succeed despite what may be some of the afflictions of the parent. I don't know if you have any other avenues.
So I have really strong beliefs on this. I love the losing position. I mean, Chipotle had terrible problems. And because, in my opinion, because of good leadership, it became an emergency. They used to call these burning platforms. But it became an emergency. It wasn't like maybe we'll make some incremental change. It's like, oh my gosh, we're in hot water. We've got to do something. And so the alarms go off. The board is ready. The investors are ready. The employees are ready. Leadership's ready. And I love that moment because it's high profile. You know, the Cambridge Analytica Facebook thing, you know, it's a high profile moment. And it really tests the souls of companies. And I think that what we'll talk about today and what we're talking about is, how do you do that? You know, being behind a few steps, I think is fantastic. I also think that Philip Morris, this is one of the ones, you know, if I am not a betting man, well, I actually am a betting man, but Philip Morris, I mean, I don't know to what extent people know what's happening in terms of the turnaround there, but these tobacco companies have repositioned themselves in some very authentic ways to be proactive with regards to healthcare, to really change the reputation, because if we know that they're having problems, they know they're having problems. And I actually would bet on Philip Morris and on Chipotle. And these are exactly the kinds of companies that we love to work with because they know that they're in need. And this is where we would love to come in and, you know, obviously future-proof with them.
It is one of those things, though, I think we'd admit, Andrea, it's like, this is not, let's do a project. I think that
no.
These companies, this is a bit of a teardown or a bit of a, how do we extend or pivot into something else? Last bit of setup for our discussion. I know one of our colleagues, Safi Bakal, wrote a really, really good article on HBR. I want to say 5 or 6 months ago. There's no date on here. But the temptation here is to boil what's needed down to a very simple formula. And I loved his formula. It was very provocative. He had about 6 or 7 different factors to it. And it made a lot of sense to my own personal experience. I think the danger, however, it makes for a really good article. It probably doesn't represent the reality of what's out there, that there's so many different companies, they have different situations, they operate in different industries. And I think profiled in our presentation and webcast today will be some of the factors, a larger group of factors that actually enter into the equation when you consider, am I ready for the future? I'm reminded of Frederick Reichelt. You might know him from... I'm not too sure if he's still alive, actually. I mean, my hope is he is, if I mention it. But he was about the loyalty effect and creating the Net Promoter Score, which was like the one number that companies should focus on, which was powerful in some respects. But when companies put it into practice, they realize there's a little bit more nuance required than just boiling it down to the one score. So any thoughts there?
Yeah, so I would say that what we believe in is, and I was also reading an article this week, and this article is from 2019, March, April 2019 issue, it says. So it's actually not, it's pretty recent thinking. The thinking that I've had is the wonderful balance between research and practice, because, you know, the theoretical approach to how to do what we're about to talk about, future readiness audit, we're about to talk about that. Okay. What does a number mean if you don't know anything about it? You know, if you can't do anything about it, it's very tempting to say, well, nice number, next year we'll revisit this, have another retreat. What we're hoping today's session does is get business leaders to feel hope, because there are tangible ways to understand what's required in today's market and to do something about it, to set priorities, to align our leadership teams, to develop initiatives. So that, just like we talked about with Chipotle, you can understand that you're behind, but advance really quickly toward, I believe, a leadership position. And I know that we both believe that. So let's talk about this future readiness audit. Walk us through the nitty gritty of it.
we're hatching something here. And I think selfishly for us, I mean, if we're going to work with companies, we should probably be able to prove out what level of effort and what the performance behind our effort was. And so Born somewhat out of, this is a real need companies have, whether we're involved or not, and born somewhat out of, we'd really love to measure what we do over a period of time. We've decided to come up with an audit that can function almost as a snapshot in time. Where are you relative to some of your peer set? And then also, if you do it multiple years in a row, you can actually look at it as the score that is the key indicator for, are you changing, innovating, growing, and transforming well? And it's interesting. It's a clumsy selling line, I guess, if you will, because we put those four words in. But as I'll profile here, I think too often these audits get very tribal. You know, you're a technologist, so you're going to evaluate the technology, or you're an IDO person, so you're going to evaluate the design thinking ability of your company. And I think the true reality is CEOs don't care. What CEOs care about is, am I going to be better in the future tomorrow? And will my customers, my stakeholders, my employees like me more and position me well for the future, right?
Great. And before we jump into this, let me preview that I am now monitoring the line. And if people have a question or want to ask it either in the Q&A or in the chat, I'll be monitoring during this next section. And also thank you for people who submitted questions in advance, because we'll be addressing those in a moment as well. So the lines are open, as they say, chat line is open. Sean, walk us through the audit.
Network or somewhere in your past, Andrew, I think, yes, the lines are open. I've got four caveats before we get into the nitty gritty of it and have a conversation about some of the factors. As much as I mentioned, Safi's kind of formula had about six or seven different factors. I think there's about 18 factors involved in getting companies to be future ready. They're in five different camps, which I've exposed here. I guess I'm teasing you as icons so you can intimate what some of those are based on what the icons look like. But I'll save it to go through one by one. But it's many multifaceted, and it's because companies are also multifaceted, and they need to have different barometers in terms of, you know, truly, I think one of your biggest measures is, am I going to be better in the future? I think I'll get your opinion on this too, Andrew, because if I think about this little cottage industry called innovation or transformation or what we're now calling future-proofing, or sometimes we attach the word innovation plus, this is really, you know, how many of them are here? About seven or eight different components of what this industry makes up. And on the front end of our four-step process, the see, learn, decide, commit, a lot of futurists and trends, you know, cover that off very adequately. Certainly designers and creative then jump in and take some of those insights and turn into hopefully some ideating gold. And then there's a whack load of other people that operate more down either the middle or the back end of the innovation process here. What we've tried to do with this audit is actually collapse everybody's combined intention here to actually look at some of these constituencies all paddling in the right direction, and are we actually achieving full future readiness? Andrea?
So the most important thing, I think, and in the minds of the people in our audience and our community, is two things. What is the currency that we're using for all of this process, and what are the metrics? And so part of what we'll talk about is, in maybe 10 years ago, ideas were the currency. And so the number of ideas, and we love open innovation as an approach. It sometimes was the case that you could count ideas, sort ideas, and ideas seemed to be the currency. The metrics would be mismatched. And I know that there's lots of innovation metrics pundits now who are coming out with a different sets of metrics for understanding stages of ideas and how to look at them. So I think that as we look at this whole process, the question that we should look at is, what is the currency? What are we trying to produce as part of each of these see, learn, decide, commit steps? And then for each of them, what are the metrics? And we'll get to a question from the audience in just a moment that's related to that. So back to you, Sean.
Once again, if I go back to, you're the new chief innovation officer, you're the head of digital transformation, you are a line function that your CEOs walked down the hallway and said, you're in charge of our next new initiative. Gulp, right? You put your head in the guillotine. And part of that gulp factor is there's five things that might not be fully in your control. So, you know, back to the whole circle of influence versus circle of concern, your company may have ambitions that are either not stretchy enough or way too ambitious for where you are currently. And so, you know, you have to deal with that. You've got some change catalysts that either are in place or aren't in place to allow your change to happen more effectively. The size and structure of your company has a huge bearing on how fast, how agile, how complete your innovation and change can be. The way your industry operates and how fast it's traveling, I think the rules of thumb in terms of being a railroad company versus somebody that's a fast-moving SaaS environment are probably quite different. And then finally, is your customer, is your stakeholder, is your shareholder expecting this level of change? Certain industries get probably a freer pass in terms of a more loyal customer that probably doesn't switch that much. Certain other industries are very happy for their customers, or actually the customers are very happy to hop around and actually be disloyal and jump on to the next train that gives them a better experience.
Well, so I'll talk about this in a really important place. So you talked about the notion of change, grow, innovate, transform. And one of the things that's most important, and there was an HBR article about it this week, you know, we all have unintended biases. So we might be really good at the change part. And so we might have happy ears with regards to how everyone wants the change. It might be that we have a transformation muscle that's really well developed. And so what we notice is unintended biases, either on the part of the organization or the leader, that assume that the entire process is going to be according to one dimension. So that's really important because we need to retrain ourselves to get rid of these biases. And the only way to do that is to surround ourselves with different leadership teams and to have metrics that are multidimensional. And we'll talk about that in just a moment.
I think just one or two other caveats too. I haven't run across an audit tool yet. They may exist, or they may exist when you get deep inside of the company, but there are really two functions that oftentimes happen. And we had an episode number 4, Kent Lawson on, talking about how he had worked at IDEO and had these great things that were ready for the marketplace and bulletproof. And they went into the parent company organization and somehow fell on deaf ears or got reconstituted 3 years later in a much different format and didn't work out. I'm not accusing either one side or the other. I think one of the reasons why myself and Andrew focus so much on corporate innovation is there's so many inherent unfair advantages that a larger company has versus a startup. They're not worried about a lot of their capital fundraising kind of schemes, and they're more worried about how do I get growth and value. So, but there is this reality that usually in a company, with rare circumstances, everybody's involved in the change. But in a lot of companies, you've got a certain portion of your population or your staff that is involved in the change, and a certain portion of your company that's involved in the entire company, which includes having the trains run on time. And so oftentimes the culture clash between the two, if not clash for resources, plays a role in terms of how good or how bad your change is able to deliver.
Well, I'll just insert one question from the audience before we go to the next section, which is the community has asked, what differences have we seen between companies' innovation capacity by stage? And I'll start with the answer to this, and then I'll throw it to you, Sean. One of the things that we notice is that the fatigue of innovation sets in. So the people who have a lot of energy around beginning things, it's almost like any other personality profile, beginning things might be fatigued by the time it comes to finding the partners and getting into the details. And so it's almost as if, and one of the things that we like about this future readiness profile is you can do it by company, you can do it by team, you can do it by individual. And so what we know is to match the people who are good at starting ideas with the stage in the process where you need to initiate. We also need to balance that with people who are going to, we have this approach that we do in workshops sometimes, which is yes and, no but. So you need to surround yourself with both people who are going to yes and you, like in comedy improv, build on your idea with optimism, but also the various perspectives on critical thinking around these initiatives at that stage. The worst thing, and Next time we'll be talking a little bit more about the intrapreneurs, but the worst thing is to put the kibosh on idea too soon, because you have to give the new ideas a chance to live without judging them too harshly in the beginning. Any thoughts on that, Sean, before we move on?
I have some numerical thoughts on that, I guess. We've got, and I'm biasing people that haven't taken our scaling innovation survey yet, but we did ask a very similar question on this one in terms of where do larger companies, corporations actually function best? And we boiled it down to three different stages. It's like the launching, the invention, the start of the innovation process, the scaling, the hypergrowth, the, you know, just starting to commercialize your innovation part of the process. And then the maturity, how do we optimize and how do we get the most out of something that's probably, you know, out of its hypergrowth phase. And I think the stats, if I'm not mistaken, about 50% said most companies have the toughest time with the scaling stage. You know, taking that little baby of an invention, taking it to marketplace and actually trying to have it have a different group of stakeholders like it. I think 35% of people said the kind of the what I would call the core innovation stage, the kind of how do I look at the world, invent something new, kind of like our see, learn, and decide stages. And then 15% said the toughest part was just the ongoing, how do I optimize and take these innovative products 3 years out and bring them into maturity. So there's some numerical stat behind that.
Great. Well, let's get into the next stage, the next section.
I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on each one of these. I think the temptation on this one could have been like, let's explore these all in many different variants. I think we'll just expose what the factors are. The first set is we've got six factors that truly are in the domain of somebody in charge of change. Whether you run it as a center of excellence, whether you're a line function, whether you run it as part of a separate company to a parent company. These are the six things that are probably more in your control than the other things. And I must say this has been about 5 years in the making, this audit tool, and we've looked at about 50 different competing types of audits, and we've taken the best and got rid of some of the stuff that we didn't need and turned into something we think is very effective. So the first one, and every one of these different factors has 10 things that ladder up to it. So if you, you know, it's almost like the Russian doll of scores where like, here's some 10 things that ladder up to the bigger thing, which is, you know, is a company good at business transformation, innovation management? And we tried to boil it down to a question that was inclusive enough. Do we have an aligned high-performing change organization that balances the why, the what, and how of change and has the authority and empowerment and safety net to succeed? And I know in previous webcasts, we've talked about this psychological safety or permission to actually innovate. But, you know, is your change organization looking around? Certainly very talented. And importantly, I think the last part of it is, you know, do they actually have some of the legitimacy needed to actually go about their business? So, Andrea, any?
No, let's carry on. I think people are eager to hear these all in a row.
The second one is just, and this is really the red meat, I think, of just, you know, can you innovate well? And most people look at that as a product exercise. I think ourselves at Future Proofing Next view it much more as a, there's a continuum of innovation that can be continuous improvement, can be product, can be something more expansive in terms of an experience, can be transformational, or can actually change the business model of the company. And so I think we tried to boil it down to the question, are we building optimized portfolios of new growth that are wide-ranging, progressive, well-governed, and actually produce what our customers want? I think this would be the second factor, and you can see some of the 10 subcomponents that build up to that question. Number three, and this is where I've spent a lot of time over the last decade, you know, are we actually looking at the future with some level of clarity? You know, is it accurate? Do we have a full understanding of what's going to happen next? And oftentimes, one of the things, I think the fifth one, market timeliness, I can tell you some of my mistakes have turned out to be, not that I was wrong, I was just wrong in terms of when some of the stuff was going to land. I wish I would have had some of my investments back in Ballard Power Systems, because the electric car was going to happen, it just wasn't going to happen in 1995. So, and do we have the rigor to turn it into timely action? Because I think one of the things that myself and Andrea, I roll at is just people that come in and it's kind of the same package of trends that everybody's seeing. And nobody really turns that into something actionable that a company can use. And so I think it's both parts in terms of having a fluency around what's next, but also being able to quickly turn that into some action. Fourth factor, talent transformation and change management. We've found the people religion this year. I think myself and Andrea, we've incorporated it into a lot of our different tools. And we've tried to boil down to the question, do we have the best talent, structure, and incentives that are open to change, actively supported, and skilled enough to achieve it? You know, you are a function of the people that are governing both the change and approving and championing the change that's around it. So some of the factors to the side ladder up to that. I think culture is this mushy type of thing we're going to talk about in a little bit in terms of the company culture, but do you have a change-driven culture that infects both the champions and the people that lead your initiatives? Last two here, I find, for the most part, innovators completely ignore the fact that there is something called configuration. You know, we are not just inventing stuff or producing stuff. Sometimes the best type of innovation is actually configuring stuff. And so from a business model standpoint, are we thinking and acting big enough? You know, are we configuring, delivering, capturing the most value from our change and some of the partnerships that we need to do to enable some of that? So I know our next webcast, we're dealing specifically with the question, what are the 52 best business models of the future? But I think if you look at some of Doblin's work and some of the work that's gone on with some other folks, the biggest return on innovation you get is when you can get into a business model type of levels of innovation. And then finally, are we commercializing this stuff well? You know, are we scaling some of the change in new ventures effectively and sustainably? And I think the real challenge here, Andrea, is there's a group of people that are in charge of the invention stuff, and then they have to hand it off to this other group of people that are in charge of scaling it and commercializing it. And if there isn't some mechanism to keep those two people, you know, communicating with each other and having shared objectives, oftentimes you have, you know, self-sabotage inside companies where one different part of the innovation continuum isn't getting along with the other part.
Well,
so
I'll introduce. Yeah, I'll introduce a question from the community and also an observation. So yesterday was lucky enough to sit with someone who will remain nameless, we hope we'll have on a future webcast, a person who's a huge leader in scaling innovation within corporations and corporate venture. And in Silicon Valley currently, but also very deeply involved with China, which I think are two of the, I mean, I'm biased, of course, but I think it's two of the places in the world that are really good and experienced at these ecosystems that drive huge growth. I mean, there's just no question that all of the companies in China have figured this out. And I think that the Silicon Valley approach to marriage between the innovation hubs and the ways that corporates can really make those work in the best possible ways, got great examples, as I said, for a future webcast. I think what's really important about this though, is that when you neglect to focus on what we said earlier, when you're talking about configuration is a team sport. Configuration is not an individual entrepreneur's innovative ideas. Configuration is cooperation. Configuration is multiple stakeholders having a win from one idea. Configuration is a sometimes sea change mindset for trends that aren't quite playing out yet, where everyone has to mentally go there before it's ready to scale. And he made this really great observation yesterday, which is, you know, over the 10 plus years he's been doing this tech transfer and cooperation from startups in Silicon Valley and China to large corporates, the real key is to build that in right from the start. The assumption that scaling is equal to idea progression from an individual basis. And so I think that these metrics, and you know, it's a little, it can kind of look Myers-Briggsy, or, you know, like we're just taking a pulse, you know, to just take a pulse. But this is an instructional insight that the team adopts early in the process so that everyone can get on board from the beginning, as opposed to ideas trying to generate in a vacuum and then suddenly have someone adopt these poor orphan ideas. I think that's the critical idea that we at Future Proofing want to add to this equation, that it's possible to do this much better than the way we've been trained. So back to you, Sean.
Yeah, couldn't say it better. I think just back to one of the caveats on some of the previous audits that I've seen, most of them haven't been all encompassing. And people go, well, I produce such great ideas. And it's like, yeah, great ideas are wonderful, but there's a whole bunch of other things that go along with actually producing innovation inside big companies.
Yeah. So tell us about these levers. I like the fact that I think that, you know, we're getting feedback from the community that these are really helpful to understand holistically. You know, what are these four levers?
Well, I think you can't escape the fact that you operate not as a little fiefdom unto yourself when you're inside a company of either 500 people or 500,000 people. You are somewhat beholden to the other people that exist in your hallway. And so I have not, with rare exception, I've probably seen it once or twice, seen an innovative organization that operated effectively without strong leadership. And so you look at any of the people that you would put on your top five innovation list, and you're probably looking at a CEO and an executive team that are motivated, they're aligned, tangibly supporting their innovation effort, and usually out in front of it. And they're understanding, big one there, understanding and championing the change required. I know there was a previous survey that asked executives, do you know the trends in technology that are affecting your future? Something like 75% of executives said, yep, totally know that. They asked the same question, same company, of the frontline staff, their perception of what their leadership is doing. Only about 20% of the staff said their leadership knew what was going on. And so there can be a little bit of cognitive dissonance in terms of, you know, are we being great leaders and engaged leaders and ones that actually know what's going on? And certainly, you know, there are 10 really good factors here that we've incorporated in some of our future-proofing kind of complete philosophy in terms of getting this right.
Great, let's do the next one.
The second one was just, you know, there's leadership high side. On the frontline side, it's like, do we have our operations and systems that are gonna get our stuff to market? Are they integrated? Are they flexible? Are they scale enough to pull off change that's needed in the future? I know, Andrew, you've spent a lot of time on the future of finance and banking. And one of the challenges of banking is, you know, everybody wants to get there. It's just to do it as a startup that is starting from zero can be so much easier than a bank that's dealing with legacy systems that may go back 60 or 70 years and are still in place. So, you know, certainly getting the operating side of the fence in compatibility with your change is also required. Third one, I'm back to talent and culture again. Whoops. Not too sure what went on there. Here we go. Back to talent and culture gain, you know, is this kind of level of change embraced by the company? Are they tackling it company-wide? And is it a 365-day effort? We've seen so many different hackathons and offsites where innovation becomes the three-day exercise that everybody cares about and then walks away, leaving the two people behind to actually mop up the mess. So, you know, has this infected across your company is a really good indicator in terms of whether your innovation is going to work. And then finally, customers and stakeholders. There are unfair advantages that large companies have. Like if you're a change group inside a big organization, you need to leverage some of this stuff. You know, they probably have wonderful channel relationships. They probably have a customer experience that people like, and many customers at that. And so, you know, are we harnessing those advantages? Are we providing some deep insight to build superior experiences or relationships with some of our most important audiences?
So I'll start with a question from the community before we start the next thing. So the question, I'll ask it and I'll answer it to give you a break. The question is, are there some things that we're inadvertently doing wrong? Are there some red herrings? And I would say strongly, yes. I feel like, you know, there's a study that was done about people who are overly confident and whether or not their level of self-confidence actually mirrors the level of competency. And so I think from the perspective of future-proofing next, what we say is, yeah, we've been measuring confidence a lot, especially in the United States. You know, this notion of how are we doing? And inside the four walls, self-measured responses. And so the question is, what are the places where we need to really challenge ourselves. And so this notion of confidence needs to come from questioning all the time. And I think that the red herring, personally, I think that the biggest red herring is we're doing fine. And then, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, the Titanic saying, is that an iceberg? No, it couldn't be an iceberg. You know, there's just this notion that self-reported data is sufficient to give leaders a sense of confidence. And we believe, no, it's not. And that's where this dynamic of future-proofing comes in. So back to you.
It's a bit of corporate arrogance, isn't it, Andrew? Like, and maybe sometimes it's not intended that way, but it's like, of course what we're doing must be good, right? Like we spend 50, 60 hours every week in this place and we're really talented and we got into these roles for all the right reasons. But there is a bit of maybe arrogance or maybe just cultural groupthink that says, yeah, there can't be another way.
I think it has to do, and arrogance, of course, we don't mean that it's intentional. I think that what happens to us is, what we observe is that there's a disconnect between data that we are comfortable interpreting and habituated to interpret versus data that's going to matter in the future. And those are two different types of data. How are we doing? You know, it's kind of like we could have made it at Chipotle, they could have made a slightly better burrito, right? If all they were measuring was that. They were lucky because they had so much pushback in terms of public sentiment that they had to wake up and do something different and have different things that they were looking at. And every single time we've seen great corporate evolution, it's been because they have seen a different data point and paid attention to it. So,
I love you brought up data because I think this is what our audit tries to do. It tries to quantify some of the things that might not be quantifiable, but as well, I think your Chipotle example is a good one because it's like they ask the question, how are we doing and what can we change? Too often, I think companies focus just on, you know, what did we do and how do we look back in time to see if that was good or not? It's more of an evaluative tool than something that proactively they can use to change. So I'll just expose the last two things that are part of, I guess, the package of 12 factors that go into kind of these are stuff, things inside the company that you can deal with. And really it's like, you know, I guess, what's the Wendy's term? Where's the beef? I mean, this is really, okay, you've done all this great stuff. All of these other 10 factors played a role in it, but are we provably winning the future is I think what we're trying to get to. And whether it's, you know, percentage of your 5-year revenues that have been based on some type of change or innovation growth, is it, you know, a higher capacity? Is it better cost savings? Whatever kind of raw outcome that you're actually looking to get is crucially important in terms of stuff, because you could be doing all the right stuff and still failing, which would lead to still fail. And then finally, on the other side of the equation, it's like, hey, you know what? Don't know if we're winning the future yet. Maybe we're doing our first snapshot audit here, but all the key signals and achievements are present for winning the future. So these are kind of the higher level umbrella stuff that you go, our funnel's looking good. We've got a great looking portfolio. Our processes seem streamlined and aligned. So it's the other side of the coin in terms of outcomes and outputs.
So I would just transition directly into this next one. I think that people are going to want to hear, in the interest of time, the whole holistic end-to-end approach. So why don't you go right into the 5 environmental levers?
Yeah, I think, and this is once again an improvement on most of the other audits that we've seen. Most of the audits I've ever seen on what is the change, transformation, readiness of companies treats companies as if they're all the same, and they're not. They operate in much different environments. Here are 5 significant ones that I think have an impact and will change the score on your audit depending on whether you end up in one side or not. Industry pace and threat. And I mentioned, you know, if you're in a railroad industry, and I don't know why I bring these people up because it has changed over the last century, but essentially you're still on tracks and you're still moving, and maybe Tesla is going to introduce something new that's going to change the speed of the train. But over a course of time, you know, it's fairly slow moving. The disruptive threats are on the horizon, but they're maybe more than 10 years away because it's such a fixed cost business. They shouldn't have the same expectation of change that a, you know, let's look at somebody like Instagram or Snapchat, where you have a 14-year-old audience that is so bent on the new feature that you're going to come out. And if you don't come out with it, there's going to be somebody around the corner with, you know, very limited kind of barriers to entry coming in, disrupting your business, and that could happen in a very quick part of time. We've seen that time and time again in social media where, you know, whoever is king today, you know, might be on the way to MySpace tomorrow in a span of about 2 years' time. So the scoring on our system would be, you know, are we operating in an industry environment that requires massive or fast change? And we actually give a little bit of a break for people that operate in industries that are a little bit slower moving, not to say that they can't have kind of some moment where they completely get sideswiped, but we give them a little bit of grace just because the demand isn't there. Second thing is, what is your business growth ambition? If you are in retrench mode, you're probably not, you know, gonna require or need to have a lot of expectations placed on you for growth or change. Having said that, if you're somebody that has, you know, needs to get to 10%, you've been growing at 3%, you know, obviously the expectation and the barrier clearing that needs to happen is going to be there. So we look at the score a little bit differently in terms of, you know, expecting us to change, grow, or innovate massively and quickly. Third thing, are change catalysts in place? And you mentioned Chipotle earlier. There may be new leadership involved. There may be a crisis moment like the Dell crisis from a decade ago or more than a decade ago. I think coronavirus right now is actually a real kind of crisis moment for certain businesses. And I would say this, when you look back at the dot-com bust of 2008, you know which brand actually improved its valuation the most between 2008 and 2010? Amazon. Essentially, Amazon took that disruption factor and turned it in a way to actually dominate a sector that they were on the path to, and they actually just accelerated their trajectory. So,
yeah. And you and I have talked about what's going to happen. Clearly, I mean, as I look out my window in San Francisco right this minute, I can see the cruise ship, the physical cruise ship that has the people from the coronavirus being unloaded as we speak. And we were talking about what that's going to do to so many different industries. The other thing is, you know, how many opportunities will come from that, right? So are there ways to use this crisis and be nimble and agile so that you're able to have vacations without germs?
Oh, could we live in that world?
Vacations without germs, business meetings that are now so many of them online. I mean, a lot of our colleagues who are in the virtual online VR, AR, and meeting business are very quickly thinking about ways to, you know, can you make TED, South by Southwest, you know, fill in the blank, how can you turn that into something that has more of an online capacity without losing the live factor? But let's keep going.
No, it's very good. So whether it's outside or inside, there are change catalysts, regardless of what you're doing inside the company that either make, I guess what we call the headwinds or tailwinds, easier or tougher in terms of creating change. Last two here, there is a bias in our survey. It's only borne out by the fact that we've seen it over and over, and it's been proven by other different research-based tools. The size and structure of organization. One reason why I have so much respect for people that do effective change inside companies of more than a million employees is it's so difficult. You have to get so many people on side and then deploy it to so many different geographies and streams of business. By the very nature, the size of an organization and also the structure of an organization, you know, flatter structures just tend to produce quicker, more enabled change. They just do. And so you might be able to surmount those hurdles, but just by virtue of their existence and being in place, it's going to make it a tougher job for you to change. And then finally, you know, does your marketplace expect this? You know, do you have a customer and stakeholder? I think you saw my stat earlier where averagely customers are expecting 28% more out of their businesses or brands every year. Some of them might be 100%. Some of them might want you to double what you're doing every single year. And so depending on which business you are, we either give you a little bit of a break because they're not really demanding change and they're probably not going to switch to a competitor. Or damn right they are. They want breakthrough change. They want it to be continuous, and they'll probably gladly discontinue buying or using your service if the next great thing comes along. So that's the five different variables that we actually go, you know what, let's factor what happens here and actually, you know, could change 20% of your score on this audit based on some of the environmental factors that you're dealing with. The last one I want to get into in our last couple of minutes before we kind of open to questions and then do some housekeeping you know, I think there is a change parent relationship here that no survey that I've seen or no audit tool I've seen factors in. You know, and it really is how much governance, dependence, and influence does the change group and the parent company exert on each other? You know, are you a satellite operation where, yes, there's investment from the parent company, but really you get to operate almost fully autonomously until you need, you know, either funding or something from the company? Or in other situations, you are an embedded part of the parent company. You're probably like a division of a company that sits in the same executive meetings, has the same CEO, and is completely interdependent on the parent company. The weighting on how you answer this audit is going to be quite different for those two different people. And some of the factors you're going to have to answer, knowing that it's more either your change group or your overall company that you're evaluating as you do this. So, which leads us to, hey, there's these 18 factors that are in play that actually really determine whether or not you're going to have a future-ready organization. We've tried to do this in a somewhat awkward infographic here, but at least it pulls it into one place. And I think this one, if you're more linear in thinking, at least talks about the five different categories and the 18 factors.
So I have a question from the community, which is, this seems confusing and complicated. Where do we get started? In answer to that, there are two reasons that we have this tool. I mean, one of the things is that there hasn't been in all of the research that we've done and the ways that we've been working with companies, there isn't a one size fits all, certainly. But there also hasn't been what we call like the hymnal at church, where everyone has the same book and you can turn to the proper page to figure out, you know, which song to sing. And so this is intended to be two things. One is find the we are here and we have an aspiration to be there. We call it now next. So state that. So that's one really important foundational idea. And then the second is to take the blinders off and allow the trends and what we call headwinds and tailwinds to inform us inside our four walls. So we have to have both the rigor of knowing what this looks like in terms of the questionnaire, the scorecard, the benchmarking, the prescriptions, and also this openness to understanding that we don't know what we don't know. And this is the first, it was like, you know, we needed it so badly, we decided we had to invent it ourselves because everyone was suffering from this. You know, we were measuring the yesterday and today and not being able to capture tomorrow. Or we were inventing tomorrow and these fantastic ideas, but not able to merge that with actual leadership priorities. And so this also includes guidance for triage, guidance for people to get on the same page, pick the page in the hymnal where they want to start, the song they want to sing together, and also understand these forces from the outside and what to do about them. Because it's very intimidating, it's very confusing, and we have made it simple. Sean?
I think in part I'd agree with whoever the commenter was. I mean, and I think the biggest challenge is there's a universe of factors out there that have to be considered. And that's what we've attempted to do here. I think the universe is large. I think to the point that you were just making, Andrew, in terms of the triage, you know, what comes out of an audit like this should be very prescriptive in terms of here's the five things that you should be focusing on, and not necessarily just the gaps, but also things that you're, you know, completely strong at. I think our tool actually, if you look at, you know, scoring this, it actually really accentuates if you're top of your industry on this stuff, you're going to get a much better rating than just a linear kind of score. And if you're really horrible at this stuff, we're going to penalize you more than you normally would too. So just to make sure that you're not having everything fall into the 5 out of 6 out of 7 out of 10 kind of ranking. So there is a questionnaire, scorecard, benchmarking, prescription tool. Some of this stuff's going to be in our book as well, but we'll be happy to send those out to people if they're interested. Just message us at hello@futureproofingnext.com. And then finally, I mean, this is what myself and Andrea do a lot of the days of our life. And so what we've developed here is a light version where we ask some of these 18 factors, and it's really, we'll probably at some point digitize this and put this online almost as the entry point into a discussion around an audit. We do have a team version level that gets into some of the sub factors involved, and does it at a business team level. And then finally, a company version that we go in, spend a couple months with the company and actually really bulletproof and corporate proof what are the change motivations that you need to be getting at. And then just some housekeeping. I know we're done on the audit piece. I think we'll open it up to questions for a minute. We have introduced this thing called FN33, where every month myself and Andrea, like every day, we share articles with each other or things that we've seen. And so why just share it amongst ourselves? We decided to share it with the world. Here are some of the things that we've looked at for March, and we're currently looking at April. And the good thing, I don't know if you want to mention it, Andrew, but for our next webcast, our book of the month from March is going to be a webcast panelist in April, right?
That's right. We're really excited that Tendai Vicky is going to join us next in the next webcast. He's the author of Pirates in the Navy, as well as a lot of other books, Thinkers 50, et cetera. And he's also a big thought leader in the field that we work in, which is the corporate innovators and the marriage between large corps and innovation specialists within companies.
So that's one thing we're doing. We've also still got, based on our last webcast, Scale Barometer Survey, which a lot of people are passing by. We've had over 100 responses to, you know, how does some, we've asked 9 questions on innovation, scale, and growth. So if you go at that bit.ly link, you'll be able to answer them and be part of some of the learnings that we get. We have a book coming out. March 28th is our now date in terms of getting it out. And it'll be really, really good. Myself and Andrew are spending a lot of time on it right after this webcast. We'll probably spend a lot of time on it again in terms of trying to get it in as many hands as possible. And also we're spending a lot of time in terms of just building out our Champions Network this month. So if you're interested in joining us on a much more kind of involved and insider concentric circle basis, we'd love to hear from you. And our next 2 webcasts, we're doing 52 Leading Business Models of the Future, and actually to the point of building a card deck out. So we're going to have an interactive card deck that we're going to produce. And as well, our follow-up one in April, our first one in April, will be about cross-industry movers and the 20 things that are really determining what is affecting some of the leading disrupted industries. So I'm not too sure if there's any questions, Andrew. I know you've been monitoring the dials.
There's one question. And before we do that, for people that have to drop off right at the hour, thanks so much to the community. This is always responsive to the community. And so our topics and the way that we approach these comes directly from everyone who's part of this. So thank you very much. And that it's a great conversation. There's a great question also from the community, which is, if we were going to elevator pitch this, you know, what is this future readiness tool? What is this all about? If we were going to just go back and say, I just got off this great webcast and we've got to do this. And they say, well, what is it? And we go, well, it's 62 slides. No, what is this? What's the difference? So I'll try my hand at this notion of auditing the ability to change, grow, innovate, and transform. And then I'll let you close it out, Sean. So what I would say is that until now, we've had a lot of point solutions for whether we're innovating, whether we're changing, growing, transforming, both from a leadership perspective as well as from an individual perspective. And it was really hard to integrate because everything was developed as individual solutions to extremely important topics. This is the first time that we've taken all of the findings based on lots of research and work in the field. We're not just academics, we're researchers, but we are out in the field all the time with teams and try to develop what we wished that we had had 5 years ago. One map, one hymnal, get everyone on the same page, and a place to do what we call wayfinding. We are here and we would like to be there. And to really let people have clear exposure to what they don't know, as well as clear guidance. So if I were doing an elevator pitch and I would say, just got off this great webcast and Andrea and Sean from Future Proofing were talking about future readiness. And I don't feel like our organization's ready. Well, what are you talking about? We measure X, Y, and Z. Well, you know, this is a way for us to all get on the same page, for us to expose some blind spots, and for us to have clear guidance for prioritizing what to do. Sean, how would you like to close us out? How would you do the elevator pitch?
That's good. We didn't even rehearse that, right? That was a new question. So
new question.
I could just answer what Andrew just said. I'll go back to some of the caveats on this tool that are different than what I've seen out there in terms of the 50 other tools I've seen. It's all encompassing. It's just not digital. It's just not customer. It's everything. It's treats companies as being different. The level of change applied to one shouldn't be necessarily the level of change applied to another. And similar to what we were talking about last webcast when we were talking about scaling, people are very good at change as they look backwards and they go, oh, we should change there. This attempts to try to change your company as you're in the moment. And so it provides some level of numerical and some level of triaging and prescription of here's where you want to go in the future. So summarizing, all-encompassing tool prescribes the best factors you should be focusing on in terms of the future and actually spits out a number that says, here's how you're doing overall benchmark versus other people, which to me, candidly, if I was a client again, I'd be wanting this tool. Boom. Mic drop, Andrea.
Well, I do have to say something funny. Thanks to Craig Stark, who just said, he noticed that I said Zed. Yes, you're welcome. XYZ. And I've also said process a couple times, which is a Canadianization of the way that I usually speak. So yeah, we run around the world. And by the way, would love to get to all the regions and find out what the differences are. So signing off.
All right. See everybody in the future. And thank you for hanging out with us today.
See you in the future.